By 2018, just a year and a half or so from now, the General Services Administration will have paid Dun & Bradstreet more than $131 million over the previous 8 years for access to and use of the Data Universal Numbering System, or DUNS. Agencies use the DUNS number to identify contractors and for other acquisition processes. In his weekly feature, The Reporter's Notebook, executive editor Jason Miller explores why a two-plus-year effort to move the government away from DUNS is finally a step closer. And he's with me now to discuss. And they have been talking about this for 2 years, Jason. Why does the government pay to use something that people get and use freely on their own?
Well, this actually goes back to the 1990s. And what's interesting about that, Tom, is they were using something called the CAGE code for since the 40s and 50s. And then sometime in the 90s, I'm not sure why, you may remember this better than I would, but they decided, you know, the government decided to use the DUNS number. And several reasons why they're using DUNS. There's definitely benefits of having this one number that's used internationally. It's easy to say to the vendor who already has a DUNS number probably, hey, let's just give us your DUNS number. But what's gone on over the years is this idea that it's a proprietary information. It's, you know, DUNS, obviously, that's their bread and butter. So they put a lot of oversight over it. So it just can't be shared and used and back and forth. Anyone can get a DUNS number, but to use it to track contractors, to understand who they are, the hierarchy of the contractors, that's what costs money. And I think over the years, GSA and others have said, isn't there a better way? Isn't there a non-proprietary approach to this? And I think that's what GSA is doing today, is saying, hey, there are other options. Let's explore them.
So they have been exploring it for a couple of years. And what is the move now that's happened that you say makes this move up a notch?
Yeah, it's one step closer because GSA released a request for information. And as we know, Tom, over the years, request information, you get a draft solicitation, then you get a final solicitation, and then you potentially get a contract award. So this is step one in a long process. But what GSA is asking for is basically very simple. Are there other ways to share this information? Are there identifiers out there? Who should this be limited to? Can we have full access to this type of information? What other options are there around the world and that they're accepted internationally? And, you know, from what I'm being told, I talked to Hudson Hollister from the Data Coalition. He says there are other options and there's a growing use of these other options, something called the LEI. Now, the LEI, for instance, is an international standard that's used by someone like Bloomberg, for instance, and others, and they say we could use the LEI, which is an open data approach, instead of the DUNS, and that would save money on both the government side, but also on the contractor side.
Is the LEI also a unique identifying number that companies acquire from some source that they can also use as if it was a DUNS number?
It's not quite a one-to-one to DUNS, but yes, it is a unique identifier, and it is given to the vendor from a source. This is a foundation, a nonprofit foundation. So it is. The difference is it doesn't tell you the health of the company like a DUNS number may do. It doesn't give you all the details of a DUNS number, and that's been one of the reasons why I think the government's liked it, is because there's so much data, and that's why DUNS can charge a fair amount of money, because there is all that data behind it. The fact that Hudson Hollister from the Data Coalition and Sean Moulton from the Project on Government Oversight both are pointing to the fact that this is a proprietary data source, and that's the rub here. Can they get away from it? And there's several reasons why, Tom. One of the reasons is the access to data. Two is the cost. But three is also that there's a better, more transparent way. And I think this is all, again, stems from the Data Act and how that gets implemented over the next, year and a half.
We're speaking with Federal News Radio's executive editor, Jason Miller. Also in this week's notebook, you're writing about a new effort in the financial management community to change how they talk about themselves.
Tom, this is interesting. Now, this came up at the Association for Government Accountants event, and I was a little like, oh, okay, that's a nice little idea. This is the Treasury Department's putting together a financial management maturity model. So before everyone sighs and their eyes glaze over, let me offer you the bigger picture, and this is why I think it's important, why I wrote about it in my notebook this week. This is the idea of getting financial managers, budget officers, CFOs to talk to the mission side, to talk to the technology side, to talk to new political appointees in a different way. And let me give you an example, Tom. Adam Goldberg, who is the executive architect at Treasury Department's Financial Innovation and Transformation Office, FIT, he says, listen, don't talk about material weaknesses and don't talk about clean opinions, but talk about what you're doing with biofinancial management to really help the agency's mission. So he's offered this example. The Fiscal Service focuses on 269 auctions. That's how they conducted in 2016. They awarded $6.9 $6 trillion in Treasury marketable securities. He says that is the money that runs the government day to day. So talk about it from a mission perspective instead of talking about it from a compliance perspective. And Tom, I think that this message is really key for not just financial managers, but also for IT, for acquisition, for HR folk.
It strikes me that this kind of simplifying of the language and putting it in terms of utility to the listener is something that these other communities could definitely adopt.
And one of the things that Treasury is trying to do through this maturity model is get agencies to think about, how do we do our processes today and how can we get better? How can we not just not get a clean opinion? I mean, that's hugely important. You know, and reduce improper payments, that's hugely important. But how can they say, what can we get to a point where we're changing when change needs to happen, or we're proactively getting ahead of that change? So the maturity model has five levels: inadequate, basic, capable, effective, and leading. And the last three, capable, it's your basically the office is supporting their agency's operations, but when something happens, there's a strain, it really has an impact on the organization. Effective is understanding you're a little bit more robust and you can support continuous improvements. Leading is anticipate the challenges and creating those solutions proactively, as I mentioned. And I think that is not just about, again, compliance, but really helping the mission area, you know, do what it needs to do and be successful at it.
Some homework for Steve Mnuchin.
Maybe a little homework for him, but also I think homework for whoever the new federal CIO is and whoever the new head of OFPP will be, and of course OPM. I mean, all of these, I think other areas can use this type of approach to really ensure that they're meeting mission needs.
We can only wait. Federal News Radio's executive editor, Jason Miller, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Tom.
Be sure to read his notebook now online at federalnewsradio.com.